540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A former Proud Boys leader is given a long prison sentence for his role in the U.S. Capitol attack. CBS's Rob Legere.
The one-time chairman of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, was sentenced to 22 years in prison on Tuesday, the longest sentence imposed in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation into the January 6th Capitol breach. Tarrio wasn't present at the Capitol on January 6, 2021, but prosecutors in sentencing papers and in court on Tuesday described him as the primary organizer of the conspiracy for which he and three other co-defendants were convicted.
A convicted killer who escaped from a prison outside of Philadelphia last Thursday is still on the loose. Danilo Cavalcante was last seen on security cameras in Chester County, Pennsylvania, early this morning. And State Police Lieutenant Colonel George Bivens says
the photos confirm that Cavalcante has not changed his appearance, but also that he has obtained a backpack, a duffel sling type pack, and a hooded sweatshirt.
Not quite that fall feeling yet. An above average temperature stretched from Texas to the Great Lakes and into New England. More from CBS's Omar Villafranca.
In Washington, D.C., the swamp feeling like a swamp. Public pools were set to close on Labor Day, but the 97-degree temps are forcing city officials to keep some open until September 21st. It's welcome relief for Steve Anlian.
It's pretty warm here, but couldn't be a better place than at the pool.
Some schools are closed due to the heat, and others have dismissed students early. Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton pleads not guilty to the 16 articles of impeachment he's facing in a state Senate trial. Reporter Chris Fox reports from Austin.
An early motion to dismiss all 16 articles of impeachment failed, with 12 Republicans joining 12 Democrats to vote it down. In the opening statements, Republican State Representative Andrew Murr spelled out the case against now-suspended Attorney General Ken Paxton.
The allegations in the articles reveal that the state's top lawyer engaged in conduct designed to advance the economic interests and legal positions of a friend and donor.
Paxton's attorney, Tony Busby, contends there's no evidence in this case.
The allegations that I just heard are untrue. Therefore, Ken Paxton pleads not guilty.
Chris Fox for CBS News, Austin.
The government is looking to push the recall of 52 million airbags in the U.S. after some deaths. CBS's Matt Piper.
The action covers airbags made by two companies and used by 12 automakers from 2000 to 2018. The parts were linked to 7 injuries and 2 deaths. After an 8-year investigation, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has now officially declared the airbag inflators from ARC and Delphi defective. It's the first step in the agency's procedure for forcing both companies to recall the 52 million airbag systems.
This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
With the news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A hopeful message for a new school year was part of the statements this morning from Milwaukee Public Schools Superintendent Keith Posley.
As we embark on another school year, I want us to be reminded of the potential within each student, within each classroom, and within all of the Milwaukee Public Schools.
The super was standing next to Governor Tony Evers and other leaders at the Maryland Avenue Montessori School this morning. MPS cut classes short today on the first day due to the heat. The Milwaukee County Zoo is seeking $22 million from the county's new budget for a rhino renovation. The zoo will contribute around $6 million, with the remaining funds expected to be covered by the county. Lake Michigan beaches in the northern part of the listening area have an advisory. Beaches in Sheboygan and Ozaukee counties are under a beach hazard statement through tomorrow morning. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Usual torrential storm turned the desert into treacherous mud, trapping tens of thousands of people amid overflowing latrines and shortages of food and water. One death at the festival is under investigation, and this latest disaster demonstrates once again that climate change intensified extreme weather events can strike everywhere at any time.
Well, they went to the desert knowing it'd be about 115 degrees, so maybe this was nice. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Hope everyone had a wonderful Labor Day weekend. I know lots to celebrate. Lots and lots. This is one of those Labor Days where I go, you know, yeah, it's our 18th anniversary. We've been doing this show now 18 years. Never thought it would last this long. In fact, told at the beginning we wouldn't make it 6 months. So, you know, as someone reminded me, I do this, I continue out of spite, and I've proved that person wrong, well, 36 consecutive times in a row. But this Labor Day, a little bit different. Outside of the celebration of the big program succeeding another 6 months, this was something to really celebrate. I mean, and the weird thing is I had one of these weird back and forth conversations about Joe Biden and his policies, and someone told me, I deserve everything that crook is going to give you. And I said, yeah, I do deserve everything that the administration does. I do. We all do. And thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for the Biden administration this Labor Day. And working people should be grateful. And this is one of those things where I said, you know, you can just say thank you. It's that simple. Just say thank you, because going to make lives so much better. And as I said, you know, what a Labor Day 2023 was. Something to actually celebrate, because labor law, it's a changing. And, you know, because as we've been talking about for the last several days, the administration is doing the stuff that I've been calling for all of the 18 years I've been doing this. Because what's happened is there's been an all-out assault by Republicans and conservative corporate Democrats on working people. Now, and I say it all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. This administration is turning the tide on that. And as we've been talking about the last several days, you know, the National Labor Relations Act is moving back towards the original intent, what I've been calling for. Because understand, the original, you know, that thing that they passed back in the 1930s, that gave employers no rights whatsoever. None. As a lawyer friend loves to tell me, there isn't a paragraph in the NLRA that has any rights for employers. There isn't a sentence. There isn't a phrase. There isn't a word. There's nothing in it. Nothing. Because what they understood at the beginning is employers had all the rights, all of the control, all of the power. And what the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, meant to do was not level the playing field, but somewhat give workers a little bump forward so that they could fight for better wages, hours, and conditions and help grow an economy. And it did an amazing, amazing job. It was the one tool that my grandparents' generation used to build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. Did it very well, which is why conservatives, 1947, over the veto of Harry Truman, passed Taft-Hartley, which created out of whole cloth this no rights at work agenda, which then, you know, began turning the tide. And we're in a moment right now where this administration saying, no, I think we need to give workers a little bit of an opportunity, encourage and enable workers to bargain collectively for those better wages, hours, conditions. And, you know, we've been talking about this C-MEX case, which is potentially a massive, massive game changer. So this Labor Day, perfect time, celebrate this moment. Something to be extremely excited about, something to celebrate. Not just the end of summer, not just the last days at the swimming pool. Did that stuff, yes, absolutely. Hope everyone had a wonderful time. But actually fundamental change. And, you know, as I said over the weekend, this is the most fundamental positive labor change of my lifetime. This is, to steal a Joe Biden, this is a big freaking deal. And, you know, not just this, they've also sped up, they're also moving to speed up elections so that employers don't have the ability to harass and intimidate and fire, do all the things that they've been accustomed to being able to get away with, while simultaneously protecting workers in the workplace. This, the most pro-worker administration of my lifetime, some would argue ever. I'm going to go FDR forever. But this is a close second. This is moving in that direction. And what did we get from the right wing? What did we hear all weekend? No, thank you, Mr. President. No, thank you for helping to bring the economy back from the brink. No, thank you, Mr. President, for dealing with supply chain issues. No, thank you, Mr. President, for you know, helping bring down inflation. No, none of that. I was watching Mitch McConnell give a speech on the Senate floor today, and he came back and he wanted to do allay any fears that he's losing his mind or having anything. And, you know, he did his little song and dance about how he was during the break all over Kentucky, you know, eating hot dogs or doing whatever he was doing. He named a bunch of cities. He said a bunch of things, but there was one line that grabbed my attention, because the rest of it was all just nonsense. It was just, you know, filibustering, you know, for the sake of there were words, basically. He could say words. Hey, God, he could say words. But he said, you know, when he was talking to people, like at the fair, because they have, I guess, the best hamburgers, supposedly, in Kentucky at this particular fair, which I got to be honest, I'm pro hamburger, wouldn't mind trying it. But he said, and I quote, that the people that he talked to said that there is too much government and not enough being done to address the economy. And, you know, I'm sitting here and I said, he didn't actually just say that, did he? That's not the message, is it? So I went back and I bumped it back a little bit, replayed it again. And sure enough, there's too much government and not enough being done to address the economy. And I'm going, how is it that you can say something that in one sentence that is the polar opposite of what the first part is? And look, you know, I know, they're Republicans. It's what they do. It's like, you know, the right to bear arms should not be infringed, but well-regulated militia we forgot about. But I look at this and this kind of thought process. There's too much government, but government's not doing enough.
is kind of weird. And it goes into this place where I recently had a back and forth with a guy who said that everyone in the country is sometimes communist. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know that I agree with that. And his argument was, is when bad things happen, they want the community, the state, they want the federal government, the local government, they want all of this assistance, and they don't want to have to do anything for it. They then want, you know, government to take responsibility. And I go, in, I guess in that vein, I might tend to lean possibly. But no, that's not what this is about. Now, again, I go back to, what did we hear from the right-wing message machine? It blew my mind that I'm hearing about drag shows again. I'm hearing about Obama again. Evidently, we're back to Obama's gay. And I'm just going, why now? Why is this a thing now? And then I'm going, you know, am I going to start hearing about tan suits and Muslim prayer rugs and terrorist fist bumps again? Are we going that far back? Is Beergate coming back? Are they that desperate to shield themselves from the little that they have to offer that they've got to drag up the golden oldies to keep people completely blinded by the fact that they've got nothing to offer? Now, here's the thing. This is the important part. And the reason I brought up the Mitch McConnell thing. They're saying there's too much government, but government's not doing enough. You're not doing enough to address the economy. What is the Republican plan to address the economy? Well, the first part, there's too much government. Don't do anything. That's their argument. Should do nothing. Leave it to the invisible man with the invisible plan and the invisible ideas who take real money out of your pocket and mine. And this is just... I'm struggling in what they're offering, because I wish they were a functional party. I do. I wish the Republicans were a functional party. I wish we could actually get something done that would move us forward. Look, Biden's killing it with what he has to work with. He's killing it. But all we keep hearing, you know, Biden's too old. Yeah, he's old and he's still killing it. He's still doing really, really good things in the face of all of this idiocy raging. There is nothing coming from the Republican Party, nothing. And this is where I'm concerned, because their followers, you know, the F Joe Biden crowd, which I've heard a lot over the last couple of days. I then turn it and go, okay, well, what do you think, you know, Ramaswamy or Christie or Haley or, you know, 45, cult 45 himself. What do you think they're going to do? What's the agenda? What are they going to bring us? What's the plan? And there isn't one. And the weird thing is they don't want one. They just want anger, because that's what's being spoon-fed. And that's where the sane and rational in our community have got to come back around and go, well, wait a second. Things are moving in the right direction. Are they perfect? No, they're never perfect. We've always got problems. We've always got things we need to address. But do I want someone who's willing to help possibly address those things and listen to what we're saying? Because understand, one of the knocks against Biden is, you know, he did all that stuff back in the 90s. You know, that's the antithesis of what he's doing now. You know, he's responsible. Yeah, he listened. He's capable of learning. What do we get from Trump? Trump has come forth and said he's looking for vengeance. He wants retribution. Not how he's going to make your life better. Not how he's going to make your kids' school better. Not how he's going to make healthcare more affordable. Not how he's going to make college tuition more affordable. Not how he's going to bring manufacturing jobs back or anything. It's all about him. And this is the frustrating place that we should all be concerned about. Because, well, we still want things for our kids. We still want opportunities for the future. We want a better economy. And this is where, you know, the Janus face kind of, you know, statement of Mitch McConnell of there's too much government, but you're not doing anything. You know, people want action. People want good governance. And when you have one party, the Republicans, who are all about destroying government, you got to wonder, why do people vote for them? Because the outrage machine, they're doing their job effectively. And that's where you and I, that's where all of us have to step forward and speak up And in these moments when they start bashing Biden over his policies, go, you know, it's just easier to say thank you because it's going to help you and your family. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let the fun begin. Marjorie Three Names had a... I wasn't going to play this clip because it's too easy. I mean, it's too easy. It's too easy to go after Marjorie Three Names. But... There's this clip out here, man. And it's one of these things that you just go, what exactly is she thinking? What exactly is she talking about? So she's talking about climate change. You know, again, you've got Republicans who think, you know, it's all a big hoax. We're wasting all this money on dealing with climate change. But this is Marjorie Taylor Greene's statement during a congressional hearing. Here it is.
Are not affecting climate change. You're going to tell me that back in the Ice Age, how much taxes did people pay and how many changes did governments make to melt the ice? The climate is going to continue to change. And there is no reason to just open up our borders and allow everyone in and continue to funnel over $50 billion or however many billions of dollars or trillions of dollars to foreign countries all over the world simply because they don't like the climate change.
She is such an idiot. But here's the thing. It's a good question, valid question. She's just asking questions. You know, this is an important question. She's just asking questions here, guys. Just asking the question, you know, how much did people pay back during the Ice Age in taxes? What was the top marginal tax rate during the Ice Age? And did governments melt the ice? Was it government who melted the ice during the Ice Age? Oh, please help me. This is why... See, again, this is why they're trying to destroy public education. So that you go, oh, wow, that must be what happens. Wow. I'm going to guess, what do you think the tax rate would be during the Ice Age? You know, Joe Biden, in fact, it was Joe Biden's tax code. That's what it was. It was Joe Biden's tax code back during the Ice Age, and it was his policies back then that melted the ice. Let's go to the phones. Got Steve on line one. Steve, how are we doing?
Fine, thank you. And yes, I mean, if it weren't so sad, it would be funny. But the idea that this woman is a congressperson in the United States, I mean, it's just beyond belief. And she's divorced from this reality even more so than the rest of her party. I mean, the unofficial Republican line is that, okay, we concede that, you know, climate change is taking place and that human beings have something to do with it, possibly a significant part of it. But what are we going to do? Go back to living in the Stone Age? That's their sort of unofficial line. Her line is some ridiculous idea of when, you know, there were about 20,000 people on the damn planet, you know, as if they were making it possible for climate change to happen. No, Marjorie Taylor Greene, this is a phenomenon of the Industrial Revolution on, and CO2 gases have a cumulative effect, meaning that the carbon monoxide that's in the air currently that's helping to contribute to global warming has been there possibly as long as 200 years, because that's how long it takes to sequester naturally, because that's what happens. You know, CO2, we burn fossil fuels, we emit greenhouse gases, including CO2. They end up in the atmosphere, and through a natural process, after a couple of hundred years, they then are sequestered naturally. But what we've done is we're doing things that are placing the world in an imbalanced state, whereby we're pumping in far more CO2 gases into the atmosphere than can be naturally sequestered through this process. And as a result of which, our planet is getting warmer more quickly than it has ever in human existence. You have to go back to a period in time before human beings existed to find warming on this scale this quickly. So, I mean, again, this is why, you know, we really do need to think about how much money we're investing in primary and secondary education, because this is not something that requires an advanced degree to understand. But again, this woman is a congressperson in this country, and this is her level of understanding. You could literally Wikipedia this nonsense and come up with a better explanation than what she has managed to articulate here. But yep. Again, I am just baffled. And the rest of the world laughs at us when the Lauren Boberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, the Jim Jordans, open their mouths. You know, the Western Europe is just sitting there scratching their heads. How in heaven's name did they get to be the wealthiest country in the world? And I can't blame them.
I can't either. You did that segment better than I could have. Because you're spot on right. I mean, the sad reality of this is where we are. And what's scary is the number of people who take what she says as gospel.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, literally, there are people, especially in her part of the country, that simply believe that, no, this can't be happening because the only one who's empowered to change the climate is God. I mean, this is what they're hearing from their pulpit, you know, at their churches on Sundays. And so, therefore, you know, all of those people who are telling him something differently, you know, those crazy people with the degrees who actually went out and did the research, you know, now they're part of some, you know, socialist plot to unseat the United States in terms of its economic standing in the world and create some sort of global socialist utopia. And climate, and this is all a giant conspiracy to forward that end. I mean, this is where these people live.
You know, you hit something a second ago. You're a smart guy. You work in the university setting, I believe. You're someone who knows what research is. Does it bug you as much as it does me to hear people who, you know, barely got out of high school telling everyone on any issue, whether it's COVID, whether it's climate, whatever it is, just do your own research, and that research consists of watching a YouTube video? Does that drive you as crazy as it does me?
Oh, absolutely. In a free society, anyone is free to discuss almost anything that they want. We have a few limitations, but beyond that, you're free to do so. But I will ask people this, I'll offer this proposition. If you have a pain in your chest and you jump into an Uber and ask them to take you to the nearest hospital, what the Uber driver thinks about that pain in your chest is an opinion in a free society. What the head of cardiology at the University of Chicago thinks about that pain in your chest is an authoritative opinion. And that's an important distinction. Nobody in their right mind would get medical advice or legal advice from some idiot with a YouTube channel. But, well, I should take that back. There probably are a few who might. But when it comes to public policy, science, anything else, they're just willing to take the word of any idiot who manages to have, you know, a following. You know, there was a time when Alex Jones had more followers than a lot of the major cable networks that were tasked with giving people the actual journalism in a free society. So, I mean, it says a lot that so many people in this country are willing to believe just crazy because they can. And they equate Alex Jones and his ilk with the New York Times. They're not, New York Times isn't always right, but they make a real effort at hiring, I don't know, people with journalism degrees, editors, people who know something about how to disseminate facts, how to actually get facts, and what to print and what not to print in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and maybe how to spell. Or use spell check. But Steve, I appreciate the thoughts. Spot on. I'm with you 100% there. I love that. No, but here, this is the thing, and you know, he's so spot on that, you know, we have elevated people who won a popularity contest to, you know, somehow thinking that they know something. And I look at Green, I look at Boebert, I look at some of the, you know, I look at Gates, I look at some of these people, and look, there's some folks on the Democratic side too that you go, you did know Hawaii wasn't going to tip over. I mean, come on. But, you know, there's a moment where you go, can't we do better? We're a country of, what, 340 million people? Is Marjorie three names? Is that the best we can do? Georgia, is that the best you can do? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got lots more to get to. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. That was the day the first Labor Day parade took place in New York City. But whose idea was it? According to the late Jonathan Grossman, former historian at the Department of Labor, the first Labor Day occurred during a general uptick in working class organizing, strike activity, and militancy that year. Peter McGuire, Carpenters Union General Secretary, is often credited as the father of Labor Day. But others assert that Knights of Labor machinist and New York City's Central Labor Union leader, Matthew McGuire, was the force behind the holiday. The machinist McGuire had been active in the 8-hour movement and later as a Socialist Labor Party politician. By the end of the decade, 400 cities nationwide celebrated the first Monday of September as, quote, a general holiday for the working man. It was already an official holiday in most states when the labor movement started campaigning for a day of recognition at the federal level. Labor militants contend that by 1894, the holiday was promoted for its respectability against the more radical May Day. Another unanswered question remains regarding President Cleveland's motives for signing the federal legislation. The widely accepted view is that Cleveland hoped to win back labor's vote after federal troops crushed the 1894 Pullman strike in early August. But the president signed the legislation much earlier on June 28th. The nationwide boycott against Pullman cars, called by Eugene V. Debs and the American Railway Union, had just begun 2 days earlier. Did he hope to deflate the boycott? What do you think? For many in the Chicago labor movement, the fact that both Labor Day and May Day are linked to the city's history is a source of pride. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
A few days ago, the city of Savannah, Georgia, took an important symbolic step toward racial inclusiveness, naming one of Savannah's 23 historic public squares for a black woman. Susie King Taylor, born in 1848 to enslaved parents, became a renowned educator, setting up schools for emancipated children and adults, a laudable role model in America's ongoing struggle to extend equal opportunity to all. Before adding Taylor's name, though, the name that had been plastered on that square 170 years ago, John C. Calhoun, had to be subtracted. Council members did that last year, finding the South Carolina senator and 2-time vice president unworthy of any public honor. Why? Well, why would Georgians of 1853 create a monument to a lawmaker from another state? Answer, slavery. No politician in our history has been a more vehement apologist and promoter of human enslavement than Calhoun. Thus, racist Southern leaders revered him. A rich son of plantation privilege, Calhoun owned dozens of slaves. More shamefully, he built his political career by fabricating a hokey economic theory asserting that slavery was such a, quote, positive good that even white workers in northern factories should be converted to slave laborers. Worst of all, Calhoun opposed the democratic ideal of majority rule, crying that it allowed the many to interfere with the freedom of the elite property class, his own, to do what they wish with their properties, including slaves. He even favored outright plutocracy, proposing that the rich should be given a special right to overturn laws they don't like. This is Jim Hightower saying, while Savannah is doing the right thing by saying no to this autocrat, beware, for the Koch brothers' network of today's plutocratic billionaires is organizing to impose his plutocratic order over us. To learn more, go to TrueNorthResearch.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been following some of the stories coming out of China with regards to their economy. Now, what's weird, again, I go back to the Mitch McConnell quote. You know, people say there's too much government, but the government's not doing enough on the economy, which is, again, a very weird statement. Our economy's nowhere near in as bad a shape as what we're seeing coming out of China. And the question is, what happens? What happens if China goes belly up? What happens if they go into economic chaos? What does it mean for us? What's it mean for the rest of the world? That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey Rick, great to be with you.
So I'm reading this article. It says the yuan has fallen like 5% to the dollar over the last couple of months. Growth is slow. Interest rates are lowering. All this stuff's going on. What does it mean?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of people trying to figure that out, right? Because it's a little bit opaque because the Chinese government does control so much of the economy and only gives out kind of selective information. So you have to surmise some of this. But it's fair to say this, that in general, China's model of economic development is heavy on industrial production and light on consumption. And part of the reason is because so many of the billion plus people there save money because there's not a reliable pension system. You know, could the Communist Party take it away at some point in time? And so there's not a lot of internal consumption like we have that tends to drive the economy. So it gets shifted into things like industrial production that is then exported in terms of products to the United States and other markets. That has effects for us that we can talk about too. Some of that they'll try to prop up the economy through real estate bubbles and construction. And there's a big Chinese real estate company that's teetering on the brink of bankruptcy that would, you know, could potentially have like Lehman Brothers type effects, what have you. But the bottom line is that China's population growth has come to a screeching halt. I mean, they don't have any immigration coming into the country. No one's moving into China actively. Why would they, really? But and the birth rate is exceptionally low. And so they're suffering from what looks like decades of what's going to be slower growth than they need. And this is going to be a big struggle for the Chinese government to try to work through this. But what has happened in the past, Rick, when we've seen a crisis like this, and I think we'll want to talk about this, is that the Chinese government response is to export as much pain as possible. So if they have excess steel, they'll try to find a market for it. And that means the steel mills here shut down or other types of products as well. And so we have to, you know, get our kind of what I would call trade radars up to be watching for a lot of this, because it could have very negative effects for the U.S. economy, which just, by the way, is doing quite well. And even if people are saying, I'm not feeling it yet, I mean, the data, you know, is good. The inflation rate is coming down. Wages have been, you know, we've seen some pretty healthy growth. The unemployment rate is exceptionally low. If you want to make a job transition right now, it's a great time to do it. So and in fact, in terms of the global economy, we're basically leading the pack right now. And of course, if you are watching Fox News, you're never going to expect that.
Yeah, because I was going to have you say that again, because, you know, everybody I talk to, oh, the economy's terrible. You know, I just bought this brand new TV or this brand new car, or I got all this stuff, but the economy's still terrible. You know, it's the weirdest kind of dynamic that we're in right now.
Yeah, it really is. And again, part of it is because it's been so politicized. Part of it is because inflation was up for a while because of the pandemic and other
and corporate
supply chains. Yeah. So and corporate greed, I was just going to say that is that if you know, you can factor out all of this other stuff, and corporate profits have been quite healthy. And so it's not like this is a Biden made kind of inflation based economy. This is a good economy where there are lots of job opportunities and good job opportunities for folks. And it's, I mean, you and I both know this. You can't always say that. In fact, there's lots of times where you can't say that at all.
Right.
So we're in a far different situation than China.
Yeah, China's in trouble. How much of it is how much of this is COVID? How much of this was going to happen anyway because of their one China policy and the fact that demographically they're upside down. They've got more older people than they have younger people. I mean, we're in kind of a weird spot too, that we've got a lot of older people and not as many, but nowhere in the trouble that places like China are in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there are a couple of long-term and short-term reasons for this. You know, the longer term reasons were what I talked about before, just in terms of like how China's economic growth is produced. The other long term impact was the one child policy that has, helped to bring down the working age population significantly over time. And you're never going to recover from that, at least over the course of the next generation. And then the short-term impetus, China had the zero COVID policy where everything was locked down and nothing was happening. And then they opened it wide open and that didn't work either. And part of the reason is because while, you know, again, China's still a very large economy, second largest economy in the world behind the United States. China exports a lot of products and it still is growing. I mean, it still has growth. It's not shrinking, but it's just growing at a slower rate. But I think one of the fundamental issues is that Xi Jinping has really is trying to alter the course of the Chinese economy to make sure that they're growing Chinese firms and not multinational firms, and that the state is gradually controlling more and more of the economy. And that's certainly having an impact on the kind of investment that China's been able to attract.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Scott Paul. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do there. Now, as you said a second ago, that, you know, clearly, and I think everyone knows what China's model is. They overproduce and then they pump and dump. And one of their favorite dumping spots has been here in the U.S. And I just saw a story about EVs coming into the country. And I guess, you know, the first ones are landing in an attempt to, you know, I would assume, you know, corner that market and basically destroy the manufacturing that a lot of us are hoping are the future of middle class employment in this country. Is there a way to stop this? Is there things in place? How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, and we may need to take some additional steps because I do think that a Chinese entry into the American auto sector is incredibly dangerous. The auto sector is the heart of American manufacturing, and you think of all the industries that feed in to auto manufacturing: glass, steel, aluminum, rubber, all the auto parts, and it's a web that stretches all across the United States. And the problem is that China's had such a head start on this EV production because of the massive amount of subsidies, which, by the way, are more than the United States could ever, than we would ever even consider, much less put into law. You know, they have companies that have been churning out EVs for a number of years now, and one in particular, Polestar, which is the Chinese company that actually bought Volvo as well, is selling Chinese made electric vehicles in the United States, and I see some around here, you know, in the Washington D.C. area, and they're going to open up, I think, something like 30 or 40 retail locations, which obviously is not as many as Tesla has or the traditional dealerships have, but still, that's a beachhead, and that's a concern. And we know that those cars have to be massively subsidized by the Chinese government, because, you know, the United States, we already, first of all, we do have some tariffs against Chinese products that should impact the price of the Polestars. Those Polestars aren't eligible for the $7,500 tax credit because they're not made in America. And so that company will get none of the subsidies. But it's concerning that they're able to sell at the price point they are because of those subsidies.
And the cheap labor and, you know, yeah, and potential slave labor. I mean, there's a lot of things, yeah, here. But what do you say to the person, Scott, who goes, well, if we're going to move towards EV, this is a good way to get the poor and the working class to be able to afford them. So we're just going to take advantage of their crisis and help folks at the bottom end of the spectrum get these cheap Chinese electric vehicles.
Yeah, well, ultimately, a lot of folks are going to be without jobs, so no one's going to have vehicles. And I think that's what the challenge is that it's better to take our time and do this right and to be able to scale up. And I do think that, you know, once you get EV sales of things like SUVs and pickup trucks, where there's the higher margins for the automakers, that they'll be able to move into the more affordable models, and that $7,500 tax credit is obviously going to be enormously helpful as well. But I think it would be incredibly defeatist to lean on Chinese autos to try to drive us into an EV future here. That would be the wrong path to take. And you're right, the supply chain, some of it is built on slave labor. And a lot of it's built on exploited labor, and it has been put together with subsidies, and they'll be able to sell the cars in the United States, you know, at an artificially low cost. And that will, we've seen this in other industries and what happens to it. And so in a lot of ways, you know, the auto industry is like the main artery of you know, the manufacturing ecosystem in the United States, and so an attack on that would have a very, very detrimental impact on a lot of communities, on a lot of industries. And I am fine, you know, Chinese companies selling their automobiles in China, they'll be able to sell hundreds of millions of those automobiles. That is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. market ought to be supplied by companies that are committed to workers' rights, human rights, and those cars to get the subsidies should be made in America too.
Well, I say all the time, I'm a firm supporter of domestic production for domestic consumption. Trade should be those things that we cannot individually as a country make. And you go back to, you know, the Adam Smith stuff, and the things that he chose to use as trade were things that were unique to those countries. Anyone can make T-shirts, anyone can make cars, anyone can make widgets and whatnots. It then comes down to, you know, who's doing it, with massive subsidies, as you pointed out, or slave labor. I don't think we want to compete in that world.
Yeah, and we can't. I mean, it's just not feasible, even with a ton of innovation or way more productivity, you know, and efficiency. You just can't do it. And we've seen what has happened to industry after industry in the United States when we have opened that door, which is why, unfortunately, I think we got to slam it shut, because I don't see any of these Chinese companies like changing behavior or the Chinese government changing behavior. And it would be foolish. And so I'm hopeful. And this is, you know, that yes, we want to reach these climate goals, and we do want to electrify vehicles, but let's do it the right way.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that it's going to be sustainable and that we're going to do it in a way as that we're making this transition, which obviously, Rick, and you know this, will have, you know, disruptive effects for folks who are making combustion engines, right? We need to make sure that that is a just transition to making those EVs that are good jobs at good wages, and that we're not importing the stuff and, you know, wrecking our communities yet again. That would be a stupid, stupid mistake.
Yet again. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because this, obviously the Alliance for American Manufacturing is nonpartisan, non-political, and I recognize that, and I'm not asking you to choose sides, but this is a political issue.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this should be, and I'm always looking for that thing that unifies the country, that pulls us back together. This should be one of those things that pulls us back together and says, no, we do want to make things here. We want to build stuff. We want made in America. We want to make sure that the things that we buy are made by our neighbors or even ourselves. Do you see this as potentially in this presidential election something that both parties agree on? Do you see this as a partisan issue? Where do you see this going?
Yeah. The answer is going to be unsatisfying, Rick, is that it's complicated, and part of it is because, you know, there should be Republicans who support EVs because, you know, some of the EV investment has been in Republican states, right? I mean, Ford's building a 6,000 person like factory outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And so if you're a politician from, you know, Western Tennessee, are you really going to say this is a terrible idea to have 6,000 jobs here?
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be tough for them. But yeah, I mean, some Republicans want to make an EV like, you know, one of these culture issues. And it's just stupid for them to do that. And they might get a few applause lines or whatever, but we can't afford to do that. And we need to be leaders in all of this. And voters should understand that these investments are coming to red states and blue states and everywhere. And so, I'll tell you this, as someone who owns a Chevy Volt, it's great not having to pay for gas. I mean, it is really, it's a great feeling. And so once somebody from any political stripe gets used to that, you don't want to give that up.
No, it's one of those things I've been saying. We have the ability to create a future that you can be off the grid. You can. I don't know why we don't have policies that, you know, solar panels, geothermal in your homes, so that you're energy independent in each individual home, not having these massive grids that we have to support. I don't know why we're not moving in those directions. Bad policy, I don't know, but there's opportunity here. And I still think there's opportunity to bring people back together. And hopefully this will be one of those issues. But Scott, as always, I appreciate the time and the good information.
Of course, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. And take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. That was the day that the first Labor Day celebration and parade took place in New York City. The New York Sun printed a vivid report of the parade of 10,000 marching workers. The paper described, quote, men wearing regalia, men with society aprons, and men with flags, musical instruments, badges, and all the other paraphernalia of a procession. The article went on to say, quote, as far ahead as one could see, and as far down the side streets as forms and faces could be distinguished, the windows and roofs and even the lampposts and awning frames were occupied by persons anxious to get a good view of the first parade in New York of working men of all trades united in one organization. All along the line, cheers were sent up. The reporter described the colorful banners carried by each trade union and noted that following the bricklayers came, quote, two decorated wagons containing brick arches. On each side of one of the wagons were the inscriptions 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for recreation. And, get on to it, the union will never surrender. From New York, the idea of setting aside a holiday for workers spread. Oregon became the first state to officially recognize the holiday in 1897. Colorado, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York established a Labor Day that year as well. By 1894, 23 more states celebrated the workers' holiday. It was that year that President Grover Cleveland declared it a national holiday in response to the Pullman strike and boycott that began in Chicago. Labor Day is the day to honor the sacrifices made by labor fighting for safe and fair workplaces.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So you may remember last week I was talking about wage theft. And, you know, I had a couple of people remind me that there are tons of stories out there of wage theft and all of the statistics. And I got a bunch of emails on that, and I was grateful. But this story popped up from Missouri, the Show Me State, and they're going to show us wage theft. A state senator there who basically he rose to prominence because of COVID, because he was going to defy that pandemic stuff. He's being sued right now by an employee who he alleges he was cheated out of overtime pay and fired. Now, I said, you know, last week, I go, you know, the reality is the reason most people don't fight wage theft claims is because, well, most workers don't have the protection of a union and don't have the ability to stand up and fight back. Because what then happens is, yeah, you may file a claim and you may win the $50, but down the road, they're just going to fire you because you're in trouble. Well, this is what happened here. Evidently, Missouri State Senator Ben Brown owned a restaurant, and the restaurant got some attention because of the pandemic stuff. But one of his employees said, hey, look, I've been working for you more than 40 hours and you haven't been paying me overtime. He brought it to their attention, said, hey, you haven't been paying me overtime. Pointed out that he was paid with a handwritten check instead of an actual paycheck so that you could track the hours, because that's part of the law. If you hire someone, there has to be a pay stub that lays out what the hours, what the wages, what the taxes, all that stuff is. And so he said, hey, you know, I want this done. He realized it wasn't included in his pay. Asked management about it. He was fired. And you go, wait a second, can you do that? Well, yeah, at will state most of the time. But this worker then filed a lawsuit for the back wages and what he is calling breach of contract. Now, I don't know anything about the firing. The firing could be under the grounds of, hey, you didn't come to work, whatever they can make up, because employers do this a lot. But I just think it's so fitting that I just talked about this. And here, well, a good God-fearing Republican state senator from Missouri showing us the way on how to be a, well, wage-thieving employer. So we'll see how this plays out. Now, hey, it was holiday weekend. Hope you had a good holiday and hope you had some family and friends over, did the burgers and fries and all that stuff. Mother Jones had an article not too long ago that pointed out that, hey, if you had any of that stuff, any of that food stuff, chances are child labor was at the heart of it, because evidently our food sector, congratulations, farmers, you are the ones that violate child labor laws the most often. And, you know, they point out that, you know, a number of states are going and trying to change child labor laws because we need cheap labor. We need exploitable labor. And I find it, this is one of those things I find really interesting, because there was another story from Florida. That said, hey, you know, these small-scale farmers who have been heavily dependent on immigrant labor coming through with the waves of, you know, the crop waves, they are not planting as many crops, not as many winter fruits, not as many vegetables this season, because nobody to pick them. Evidently, DeSantis's immigration laws have put them in a position where there's nobody to do the work. So they're not going to invest money into planting crops that they know are just going to rot in the fields. Congratulations, DeSantis. But this is one of these weird things where you have the Republican policy of we're gonna cut all this off, so nobody's gonna go work in these fields, and then you're going to have those Republican areas who are then starved for labor. How is this going to play out? Because understand, the rural communities, those are the ones that are heavily conservative, heavily Republican, heavily.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.